Next, last but not least, definitely, we have Gary Schindel with the Edwards Aquifer Authority, and he's going to give us an overview of the springs of the Edwards Aquifer. Gary's, in his bio, he had actually said that he'd worked in more than 35 states and 5 countries and is a registered geologist in 4 states. He's currently the Chief Technical Officer for the EAA in San Antonio. He was also the Director of Karst Hydrology for a consulting firm. Served as an environmental manager for an office of ATEC. He's done a lot of great things. He's very involved with aquifers, and let me let him get started.
Well, thank you very much. Hey, Laura? Oh, get my glasses on.
The final training session of the day.
Yes, okay.
Okay, this is the plan.
Okay, good.
And then this goes forward.
Okay, I think I'm fine. There we go. Let's go back. There we go.
Okay.
If you want to kill the light all the way down, appreciate it. Thank you. My passion has been springs since I was an undergraduate, and my interest and background and training is in karst hydrology. So I've looked at springs every chance I've got. I've been fortunate enough to see some of the largest springs in the U.S., which surprisingly are not in limestone. They're actually in lavas. Up in the Idaho area along the Snake River Plateau, some of the springs over there kick out more than 1,500 cubic feet per second. If you ever get a chance to go see them, they're quite fantastic. But that's not to diminish the size or importance of the springs in Florida or Texas or Missouri or some of the other places we've looked at them. But I've also been working on developing some tools and using some tools to try and understand how these springs function a little better. So what I'd like to do is give you just a quick overview on some of our thoughts on how we categorize springs, as well as just give you a little bit of an example or taste of some of the research that we're doing in the Edwards Aquifer related to tracer testing. It is a tool, but not the only tool that can be used to look at some of these springs. But let's see here. This is Comal Springs. Y'all have seen a number of pictures of that today. And this is actually, if you look at it, it's kind of green, and that's because we've got some dye coming through that we were working on a dye tracing experiment with, so I thought I'd show that. But that's one of the cases where the dyes are actually visible at very, very low concentration. Let's see here. What are springs? Basically, they occur where the water table intersects the land surface. They're characterized by convergent flow, which is kind of an unusual concept. But if you think about it, they have a very large catchment area, just like a river. And basically that water is pulled underground and basically to emerge at a spring or spring complex. And there are some very good examples of that here in Texas as well as many other places. They may have rapid groundwater velocities. Now, you have to be careful with how you date water and how you understand water, but in essence, what we find is that sometimes these appear to be old waters. You can actually take a water sample, have it evaluated using some very sophisticated analytical techniques, and they'll give you a groundwater age. But you have to understand that is a mixture. It's like asking how old is the water in the ocean. Well, to be honest with you, the bottom of the ocean, the water may be 10,000 years old and hasn't circulated to the top of the to the surface in 10,000 years. In other places, the water is minutes old because it's raining on the surface. So these are mixtures, if you think about them. It's convergent flow, bringing lots of different water types together in one place to discharge. Let me see if I can bring this back to you. They may have rapid groundwater velocities. We are seeing groundwater velocities in places of a mile per day. If you think about it, we put unique tracers or dyes into a sinkhole or a sinking stream or some other feature, and it may move through the aquifer in many cases, thousands of feet per day, sometimes as quick as a mile per day. There are places where tracer tests have been run in carbonates and limestones, basically, that exceed that velocity even 2 miles per day. So sometimes these things can be quite rapid. They can be quite slow. They may change depending on rain. During the drought conditions over the last 18 months, groundwater velocities may be very slow. The rainfall we've had in the last 2 weeks may push those velocities through very, very quickly. They have defined flow paths. What that means basically is that we can actually trace these things out if you have enough time and money and interest. There are some very interesting tools that can be used to help define what that spring shed is, something that a number of the other speakers have talked about. They may be susceptible to water quality and quantity degradation. We're seeing that in the case of pumping. We've already seen a number of cases today where springs have been pumped out and gone dry. Sam Solomon's probably the best that comes to mind. But all the springs are susceptible to that. There's no magic water back there. There's not a magic water machine behind the spring that creates water. It basically is a watershed. It is the water that discharges out of the spring is a function of the size of the basin that feeds it, as well as precipitation and a few other factors, the geology and that. But in essence, there is no magic water. Water into the ground has to come out. What goes down has got to come up. And so if you think about it, the water discharging at the spring is the water that went into the ground minus what's been removed by evaporation or transpiration or pumping, and then the rest of it has to emerge at some point. Most springs are most commonly found in carbonates. We do have some basalt springs in Texas, not many, or let's call them lava or igneous rocks. And some sandstones, they occur. There's gyp springs and that. So there's all kinds of different types of springs out there. The carbonate or limestone springs are probably the ones that are most famous. The big four, the Knockfer springs, the Edwards Balcones Escarpment springs are all coming up out of the limestones. And if you think about it, discharge is proportional to the size of the recharge area. If you've got a really small seep, it's probably not draining out of Lake Michigan. Which was a common misconception when I was working in Kentucky. Some of the large springs in Kentucky, people would say, well, I hear that water drains out of Lake Michigan. It's like, no, it's generally locally derived water coming from 5 or 10 miles away. Now, that's not necessarily the case with the Edwards. We've got one of the best examples of spring flow piracy in the U.S., if not the world, and I'll show you some examples of that in some slides here in a minute. But in essence, if you have a small spring, chances are you've got a small recharge area. If you've got a bigger spring, it's a bigger recharge area. You can actually estimate what the size of the recharge area is by knowing what the base flow is if you've done some studies on other springs in the area. When I worked in Kentucky, we used this as a common tool to try and determine whether a spring might be impacted by the what I'll call the Friday afternoon, and today is Friday afternoon, the Friday afternoon spill of methyl ethyl double death. So the question was, it went into a sinkhole, where is it going to come out? The answer is, I don't know. We haven't done any dye tracing over there. The general rule of thumb is do not dye trace with gasoline or diesel fuel. It does not make good dye tracing agents, but you will find it. And you could actually, doing quick spring surveys, try and estimate whether the potential for that spring will be impacted by the size of the basin. And that. So it was actually called the normalized base flow concept. We'd like to try and apply it to some of the springs here in Texas to try and understand their vulnerability. Let's talk about different ways to classify them. Meisner, in his 1927 paper, basically described them as first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth order magnitude springs down to what we would call a seep. But you can see this is the big ones. These 100 cubic feet per second springs. Texas has a few of them. I'll show you the list in a minute. Florida has a lot. There are a number of them in Missouri and also Idaho and Oregon and that. But the big ones and probably the most famous areas are in Florida. But we've got some of the biggest here. If we weren't withdrawing water out of the Edwards at all, these things would be on par with any of the size large springs. The Comal and San Marcos Springs would be on par with anything in Florida. So let's see if we can... And so here they are listed with discharge. What's interesting is these are also different types or classes of springs. We'll talk about how you can classify them by geology. But you can see these are the top seven: Waco, San Antonio, Barton, San Felipe, Goodenough. This one is a very intriguing spring because my understanding is that it has recently been dove by cave divers. And you have to dive through about 50 or 60 feet of water through the lake, and they've gotten into an orifice and been able to pull themselves down through a shaft that's over 300 feet deep right now. And it's got warm thermal water coming up at depth. So there's some question as to even what the recharge area is. There may be some good supporting evidence that it may actually be coming out of Mexico. But really intriguing, third largest spring in the state. Very difficult to determine flow now that we've got 60 feet of water put over it, but it still creates a boil on the lake, Lake Amistad, during high flow conditions. There's a couple different classification systems. The gravity we've talked a little bit about. There are alluviated springs, ones that have been filled to some extent with gravel that may not have an open or defined orifice. Where sort of the mouth of that spring has been dammed by gravel and that. Some people classify them. There's artesian springs or Vaclusian springs. It's named after a very famous spring in France that basically comes up from great depth from over 600 feet in depth, which is not which is very similar to maybe the depth that springs like Comal and San Marcos come up from. And we'll discuss a little bit of that in a minute. And then we have submarine springs. We don't have any really, any I'm aware of in Texas. There may be some off the coast, but I don't think so. But Florida and some of the other states, the Yucatan, Belize have some very famous ones where there's actually fresh water welling up in the middle of the ocean. And some of these were known by sailors as important water, fresh water sources without having to necessarily come ashore. Very handy if you're a pirate. There's a you don't, that way you don't have to go ashore, you know. There's a number of methods that can be used for delineating the recharge zone for springs, and we're going to talk a few minutes about some of these, and then I'm going to show you an example of one method. But the geologic mapping is a very, very quick and dirty way to maybe do that if you already have a fair amount of geologic work that's done, if you know something about the springs. In the sense that if you know that you have a limestone, a spring that's coming out of the limestone, chances are it's being fed from where the limestone outcrops, and so you wouldn't want to go over and look at an igneous or a sandstone body for the source water. It may be there. There are certainly cases where these rock types will feed into carbonates, but generally you can do some geologic mapping, and it'll give you a rough idea where your recharge area is. Hydrologic mapping, that's always good too. You can go in and you can look for wells and then measure the potentiometric surface and coordinate that with lithologies and geophysical techniques that you use for delineating the geology. Normalized base flow calculations, we kind of estimated you can use that to calculate the area of a watershed, but you can't necessarily use it to tell you where it is, only that this is the size. If you couple all these three things, you can sometimes get a pretty good approximation on your recharge area by just looking at the literature, looking at some of the geology in that. But to really know for sure, the best technique is tracer testing. That way you basically take a unique identifier, a soluble material, a dye, you inject it into the ground, and then you look at where it comes out. And then you can use that, do that enough times, you can actually figure out what the groundwater basins are in that. There are some other techniques, modeling really, I have not found that to work very well. It is very, very expensive, but it's only as good as the geologic data that you have and the hydrologic data that you have. And so by the time you do that and some of these carbonates, you may be better off actually doing the tracer testing than doing the modeling to at least define or delineate the recharge area. Now, there are advantages to modeling, looking at resource management issues and that, but you don't necessarily want to use them to delineate your recharge area very easily. And then, of course, water quality testing and that also can give you an idea. So there's a number of tools that you can use to lump these things together and try and get an idea of what your recharge area is. Okay, there we go. Now, this is the Edwards Aquifer. I wanted to just highlight a couple of these. You can see there's San Marcos Springs, Comal Springs, which is the largest spring in the state, Waco Springs, San Antonio, and actually San Pedro Springs Complex. There are a couple other springs at Brackettville, San Felipe's out here, and then Goodenough's way out here, way past Del Rio and that. But they basically all discharge out of the Edwards, out of the deep artesian portion of the Edwards, but we're going to show you some examples that may not be completely true. But you can see that there are three major segments to the Edwards here. There's what we call the contributing zone or drainage zone, and this is basically water coming off of the Edwards Plateau, the dissected hill country, and the water basically will flow through the impermeable or less permeable units of the Glen Rose limestone, even though the Glen Rose itself is also a very well-developed karst aquifer in places. It will basically form the headwaters of these major rivers, Nueces, West Nueces, Frio, etc. And then what happens is as it comes down here, it will cross the light blue area where the Edwards recharge zone is outcropping, and much of the water will sink into the ground. And what's interesting is this is one of the best examples of stream flow piracy in the world. You have water from the Nueces Basin that would normally flow down here and into the Gulf of Mexico is being captured by the Edwards Limestone and is being basically transmitted underground 150 miles to the east to discharge either San Antonio, Comal, or San Marcos Springs, depending on the flow path. So these are phenomenal examples of what we call stream underground piracy of surface streams and that. And it occurs across the entire Balcones Fault Zone section all the way up into the Barton Springs segment. Basically the same process occurs. This is a kind of a cross-section of the Edwards. It's stylized. please do not make the mistake of thinking that this is the scale by any way, shape, or form. I've had geologists who don't understand hydrogeology, this karst hydrogeology, and they tell me your map is obviously wrong because you're showing these caverns here on this scale as being 100 feet high. And I say, you know, I have the same problem with the maps to Austin when I drive from San Antonio to Austin. It shows the interstate's 2 miles wide, so why do we have traffic jams? So don't do that. This is kind of a artist rendering of maybe what these things should look like. But really, I'll tell you the conceptual understanding of how to look at these things. The way I look at them now is we have a pipe, and that pipe is continuous, and it's wrapped by a sponge. And so it's incredibly permeable. That's why we get some of the largest yielding wells in the world here. We have wells that pump more than 5,000 gallons a minute with no measurable drawdown. So if you think about that, this thing is, in essence, the well that pumps 5,000 gallons a minute is not large enough to stress the aquifer. So under those conditions, technically, the transmissivity, that one of the properties that we measure for how easy water is to move through rock, is infinite. Well, it's not infinite, but it's pretty dang high. That's how you can get a catfish farmer well that pumps, that basically under artesian conditions flows 30,000 gallons a minute and shoots a head of water 30 feet in the air. So we are very, very blessed by probably one of the most prolific aquifers in the world, certainly on par with the Florida aquifer, even though the Florida aquifer, I think, has larger well fields than that. I don't think they have a larger well than the famous catfish farmer well. I could be wrong about that, though. This is to give you an idea of the drainage area. We have water, basically, or the contributing zone. We have water coming off the Edwards Plateau or the Hill Country, which is basically just the dissected Edwards Plateau. It sinks into the ground. It comes out of springs. It flows across some impermeable marl beds. It hits the Edwards Limestone, and it goes underground. Maybe some of you all have seen some places where this occurs. Probably the best example of that, Saco Creek. And it basically then is pirated, is brought down through a series of faults. Some of these displacements are as much as 600 feet, and then basically flows into the picture to come out at Comal or San Marcos Springs. And there may be places where some of these conduits that we intersect are 100 feet high. I've certainly been in caves that are 100 feet high in places. But the fact is that they're interconnected. We know that because the biology tells us that. We have fish that live 800 feet below the surface that are blind, that have no eyes, they have no swim bladder, they have no pigment because they don't need it. And they live, they're just living their lives fat and happy right there underneath the city of San Antonio. They've never been seen in the wild. They've only been seen when they've been pumped out of wells. But we know they're there. There's a whole highly developed ecology of critters here spread throughout the aquifer, and they basically are living in these voids. So we know the voids are interconnected. We know they can transmit large quantities of water. We know that if we pump large quantities of water out of it, then there won't be as much to discharge at the springs. That's just a given fact, the way the water balance works. Just to give you a picture, Waco Springs, this is one that a lot of people haven't seen, but it's a beautiful spring located on the Guadalupe River, right at the Waco, I think it's called Waco Falls Campground there. But there are two different springs there, and we're in the process of trying to understand how this spring functions, whether it's actually, it's in the Edwards Limestone, but is it draining the Edwards or the Trinity, or is it an overflow spring? The hydraulics of the Edwards we're trying to work out with tracer testing, and I'm going to show you some examples of some of that work that we've done. We've done a lot more than what I'm going to show you, but this will give you just one other thing. We were talking about wells and the amount of water being pumped. This is in acre feet, withdrawals from wells in acre feet per year. I don't know what an acre foot is. It's such a weird unit. As a hydrologist, it's a very difficult field to work in because we have metric units, liters per second. We have gallons per minute. We have cubic feet per second. We have acre feet. I think we ought to change the numerics and all go with one system, and I'm going to propose that we go with cubic furlongs per fortnight, and then and that would solve all the problems. And you wonder, you know, when you mix these units up, you wonder why people bounce satellites or bounce a spacecraft off the Martian surface, because one guy's using miles and the other guy's using kilometers. and it causes some serious problems. But anyway, we measure things in the West in acre feet per year, and this is showing you from the 1930s here, 1934 on up to about 2003, the estimated pumping amounts from the aquifer. And you can see they probably peaked about 1985, and then they come back down, and they hover around 400 to about 420,000 acre feet per year. But that's water that basically is coming out off the top or skimmed off the top of what's coming out at Comal Springs. So if you think about it, there is no free water. Again, what goes down, it's got to come up. If you pull it out before it comes out the springs, then it's not available for recharge or discharge. So it's really just a question of allocation of water resources in many cases. We're lucky that the Edwards does have a huge volume of water in storage, but if you think about it, as long as the springs are flowing, then we have a surplus of water coming out. The aquifer's full. When the springs stop flowing, then the aquifer is starting to be diminished. If you continue to pump greater than the recharge amount going in, then you're mining the aquifer and the water levels will drop and the springs will dry up. And that's true with any spring, not just Comal Springs. It's just the basic nature of hydrology. Okay, let's talk a little bit about this interesting tool. It has not been used very much in Texas with the exception of the Barton Springs folks who have been doing a great deal of dye tracing, some very, very fine work. If you've been fortunate enough to see Brian Smith and Brian Hunt's work on the Barton Springs stuff, it's just first rate. That we have been trying to do similar works with our portion of the Edwards. We're a little bit bigger aquifer than they are. They're a little farther north. There's a groundwater divide between us over here in Kyle, we think. What I want to do is just kind of look a little bit at Comal Springs to try and understand maybe some of the piping, how these springs function. What I'm going to do is show you, this is an aerial view of Comal Springs, and if I can get the little pointer things over, this is basically the Comal Springs fault that runs right like that between the purple arrows, and there's about 800 feet of displacement on that fault. There's a fault that basically is vertical. So over here I guess I'm the last one and the batteries are dying. So anyway, on the upper left hand portion of the map, the Edwards limestone is actually exposed at the surface. To the lower right-hand portion of the map, the Edwards is where the lake acts as a boundary. The Edwards has actually been pushed down and is about 600 feet below the surface. Okay, and you can put your foot on that fault. It's very impressive. If you get a chance, go out there and look at it. But really, Comal Springs is really a spring complex, and so we have two components of the aquifer coming together. We have the recharge zone to the north and to basically the upper left. And we have the artesian zone to the lower right coming out here. And so what we did was we decided that we would try and do some dye tracing here to see whether certain properties of the aquifer hold true. In many cases, as a hydrogeologist, we're trained using a thing called Darcy's Law. And it's kind of the governing equation for groundwater in sand and gravel aquifers. But it doesn't seem to work very well in carbonates and limestone aquifers, and especially in springs where you have where you have flow paths basically coming together, because you may have things like turbulence and flow, and you have some other issues that may not be occurring. You, instead of having the water flow in between the grains and the pores and the rock like you would think of water flowing in a bucket of sand, what it does is actually flows through conduits. And so you have pipe flow conditions, and that's not the equation you use for pipe flow. So what we were interested in doing is seeing if this is true, if this holds true. So basically what we did was we injected one dye into a well where the red spot is. It says Panther Canyon well, and we put an eosine dye in that. And then we injected another dye called uranine into where the green dye into a thing called the LCRA well. Well, the LCRA well is 600 feet deep till it intersects. It's actually about 1,000 feet deep, but it intersects the Edwards at about 600 feet below the surface. And so we had to inject dye, and that's actually a flowing artesian well, but we injected dye down that well, and we also injected dye, a different dye that we could see down the Panther Canyon well, which is basically in the limestone as a water table well. So let's see if this will work. And this is a cross-section of that fault. So here is the Edwards basically exposed at the surface up here, and then here it is exposed below the fault. This is the fault plane itself, so you can see this big displacement here, and this is the LCRA well coming down there. So we injected the dye at great depth here, and we also injected some of the dye right there in that well. Okay. And this is us. This is a flowing artesian well, so we had to rent a cherry picker device and actually shut the well in with a pipe, and then we ran tubing down that well, and we injected the dye down the LCRA well. And these are basically the two injection times. Injection LCRA was 11:15. It was 2002 we did this work. And then another one was 11:37 in what's called the Panther Canyon well. And so this is the results. What we did was when we injected the dye, we found that instead of the dye flowing to the closest large spring, which is right here, the one actually which is right there, instead of flowing right to there, we found that the dye flowed out and came over here to what's called Spring Run 3. So a lot of people think that Comal Springs itself is that spring that has the historical marker by it right by the road. In reality, there are springs that flow here. There's about 25 of them here. They come up in the middle of the lake. They come out here. There's one in the island here. There's about three or four over here. So about 30% of the water comes out of this spring, but that dye didn't go that way, which was actually the shortest route to get to the springs. It flowed out over here. So the plumbing on these things is complicated. This is our dye breakthrough curve. We actually had a sampler set up that would run it through a flow cell. We got, I don't know how many thousands of points there, but it took about, 3 hours for it to come through, 2.5 hours. We collected samples every 15 seconds for 2.5 hours. And you can see that's a beautiful, let's see if I can get back here. Come on, sorry. But if you look, the other dye we injected was into the LCRA well. It didn't go to the closest spring either. It ended up coming out in the middle of the lake. Now, this is coming out from the deep artesian zone. So, in essence, what we've got here are gravity springs occurring from water flowing in the upper left-hand corner. And then we've got deep artesian water coming up from over 600 feet in depth coming out these springs to discharge for a total of about 300 and, I don't know what I hit, but it's not good, is it?
Let me go.
I'll wave to you from down here. You can. So anyway, but in essence, what we found was is that dye came out not where we expected, not at the closest spring, but came out way up into the headwaters of the thing. It came out in 36 hours. So very, very quick groundwater velocities. We measured the groundwater velocity of the Panther Canyon, the red one, at 2,000 feet per day. We measured the other one at 1,000 feet per day. This is the breakthrough curves for those. The red one is the red dye, the breakthrough curve I just showed you, a compressed time scale. The green one is dye trace is the other dye that we had come out. And you see this interesting zigzag pattern. And that's because the place we were sampling the dye at was at where the lake discharges. And this is the dye moving through that clear, beautiful lake at Comal Springs. And it's getting broken down by sunlight. And then as it becomes night, the dye cotton, the sun no longer breaks the dye down, and the concentrations come back up. And so and the springs at that point were flowing at about 350 cubic feet per second. Are we good? I don't know. It got stolen. Oh, I think we may be getting batteries changed. Thank you very much. Oh! All right.
Okay, I won't touch you again.
Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and take that off and then just advance.
Okay. Yeah. What about, it's probably my fat fingers. The other thing we did was we injected, when we did that, there was a well across the lake from us called the MDU well number 5. We turned that well on, and after 3 days after the beginning of the test, right there, we turned the well on and pumped dye right into that well. We then shut it down and let it flow under artesian conditions for a couple of days, and then we turned the well on, and that water and the dye concentration came right back down, showing you how vulnerable some of these wells are to potential surface contamination. So we pulled this right into one of the major public water supply wells. We've done that both at New Braunfels and we've done it at San Marcos as well. Okay. All right. So here's it was injected Panther Canyon. Basically, we reached the peak at about 4 p.m. with below detection by 9. It was visible in the spring run for about 2 hours. And we estimated that has an approximate groundwater velocity of 6,000 feet per day. So this is moving along. Okay. The other one we used was the uranine. It was basically recovered in the new channel. It took about 36 hours to come through. We estimated groundwater velocities The distance is, we estimated groundwater velocity about 2,000 feet per day. All of the dye that came through with the uranium trace was below visual detection. We picked it up with our analytical instruments quite easily. The other thing we did was then we decided, well, is the Edwards Aquifer a porous media? Does it act like a sand and gravel? Does it act like a cave, a conduit system? So we plugged some of the data that we knew from some of the tests that we've done that have been done by others in the region to try and calculate what the velocity was. Because we've measured the velocity, so can we, right there, that V. So we were trying to look at whether these properties will help. So we threw it into this neat mathematical equation. And don't worry about all the math. Hopefully it's right. We ended up with calculating the groundwater velocity of dye to move from the LCRA well out to the springs at 11 years if we used Darcy's law. In reality, it took 36 hours, so something's wrong. And I don't think Darcy's wrong, to be honest with you. His equations are correct. We're just misapplying them. And the problem with that sometimes is when all you've got is a hammer, everything becomes a nail. If all you know is Darcy's law, then that's what you've been taught as a hydrogeologist, then that's what you're going to apply. In reality, maybe you should be applying some other methods. So there are other equations that can be used. They just don't. They're hard to use because it's very difficult to calculate some of the parameters because I can't tell you what the roughness coefficient of the conduit that the water's flowing through is. It's a very hard thing to measure. You can do it in a pipe, but you can't do it in a cave that's 600 feet below the surface. So anyway, the question is Darcy's law valid for Comal Springs? No. And is the area what's called a porous media equivalent aquifer? Is it a sand and gravel aquifer? And the answer is no. So we're starting to make some inroads and trying to look at the Edwards maybe a little bit differently than it has been in the past because in many cases it's been treated like a sand and gravel aquifer. We've also used these equations to basically figure out, well, if we know what the velocity is and we know what the discharge is because we measure it, can we calculate the area of the conduit inside there? And knowing, again, making some rough estimates in that, we can calculate the approximate size or mathematical size of the conduit maybe. So there's some big holes down there, and this stuff is moving water through it. That's what we think. And these are rough estimates, but they may be in the ballpark. I've certainly been in caves with a 100-foot diameter before. And that's assuming that. So that's the Comal Springs trace. It's just kind of a demonstration on what can be done with some of these tools and these interesting karst aquifers. We have been doing a lot of dye tracing in the San Antonio area, northern Bexar County. We have started to test some hypotheses that are false barriers to flow or not. A lot of people have thought that these faults, when you get large displacements along them, they act as a barrier. What we're finding is that we're tracing right across these things perpendicular to them with groundwater velocities of as much as 10,000 feet per day across six major faults with more than 350 feet of throw. So our assumptions as geologists that we sometimes make don't necessarily hold true when you start to test them using empirical data. These tracer tests are very powerful tools for testing that. This is just to show you some work that we've been doing in the San Marcos area. This is some dye tracing that we've done along the fault throw. So this is the deep artesian zone. This is the Balcones Escarpment, basically the recharge zone here. There's a Wonder Cave. Some of you all may have been there. It's a commercial cave. This is the Spring Lake at San Marcos Springs. What's called Ezel's Cave, which is a wild cave, and another one called Primer's Fissure. And we've been injecting dye into some of these, and we're finding that this stuff is moving in this area at 2,000 feet per day. It moves to the springs, is very clearly pulled into some of the pumping wells here that San Marcos uses. We've also pulled into some of the pumping wells here. We've also injected dye here at what's called Rattlesnake Cave, and it's come right out into the springs very, very quickly. Then we decided we would go out and get brave, and so we injected dye into a cave right here, and we injected dye into a cave right there with the assumption that it would go there. And what we found is that these dyes went there, and they're sitting now in a well and have been there for over a year, and they've discolored the well, and we've got a carbon treatment system on it. I don't know what it's trying to tell us, but it's something pretty important. And these are Ginner diagrams that show you that maybe this dye didn't go that way. Maybe it went up here and then flowed like that. I don't know for sure because the dyes help you put together flow paths, but they don't define the flow path. in the sense that I can define this flow path pretty well because I injected dye here, and I picked it up there, and then I picked it up there, and then I picked it up there, and then it came over here. And so we can define these flow paths, but when you get a long flow path here, you may or may not be able to tell, well, what was the actual path this dye took? Did it do that, or did it do this, or what? And so we're still trying to work this out. I pondered this for a number of years. This has been going on for almost 2 years now. And it's trying to tell us something, and I think it's trying to tell us something very important. And it has to do with the ability for the Edwards aquifer to assimilate, to be able to absorb or dilute out contaminants to some extent. And it supports some of the new theories that we have about how the Edwards is being formed. And it appears that we've got an excellent example of what we'll call a model that was actually developed in the Ukraine called vertical transverse speleogenesis. And basically what that says is that water is, instead of these aquifers being formed by water sinking into the ground and then flowing out on some surface spring under what I'll call gravity conditions, in reality they're being formed by water being driven upward under artesian conditions. So even though we see water sink up in the recharge zone, in reality it flows some miles, 4 or 5 miles, before it hits the artesian zone and then becomes under artesian pressure. And what's happening is that these things are working their way up. And that explains, in many cases, the way some of these contaminants and some of these dyes behave. It explains why we have the springs where we have them along flow paths, and it explains to some extent why we have a thing called the saline water-freshwater interface and why it's where it's at. What's more interesting is that it appears that some of the caves that we thought were recharge structures are probably actually old paleo springs. So if you've been to San Antonio, you've been up to some of the parks in that area, there's one up on what's called Stone Oak Parkway called Bear Cave and Cub Cave, and those are have been thought to be recharge features, and they certainly act as recharge features now, but there's now good, strong geologic evidence that these things are probably old, very, very old paleo springs from when the Edwards used to discharge at that level. So the dyes, as well as some new thinking about how the aquifer performs and why it is where it is, why you can drill wells almost anywhere in the Edwards and get very, very high yields versus in Menard County where you drill a well and the average well up there gets 5 gallons per minute. Same carbonates are, in essence, limestone formations, but why is it different and the Edwards is not? And it seems to be explained quite well by this artesian processes and that. So very, very interesting. I think we'll be writing some papers up on some of this work. But the big thing I wanted to do is just introduce to you all some of these techniques that can be used that you may want to apply. The only thing I would tell you is that if you are going to be doing the dye tracing, please be very, very cautious. It is an art as much as a science. There are not really very many people in the state who are doing it well. And if you don't use the right dyes, it at worst won't tell you anything. And at best won't tell you anything, and at worst you may very well cause a serious contamination problem because the dyes themselves, you need to be very careful about which ones you use. We use only non-toxic dyes, and the dye nomenclature is so weird that if you don't work in it very commonly, you'll have problems. So if you're interested in having some dye tracing done, consult an expert is what I'm telling you. Great. And since it's so late, and I work for the Edwards Aquifer Authority, therefore I guess we won't have any questions because the Edwards isn't a very controversial aquifer. Anyway, thank you. Uh-oh, I was wrong. Yes, sir. Well, you know, any time that you apply you have to be careful in evaluating the tool that you have to make sure that it's correct for the aquifer type that you're using. And what I mean by that is that you will see that if you pump water out of the system and that you may have one well that responds very, very well and you can pump huge amounts of water, and then you may move over some feet, some hundreds of feet or thousands of feet and have a well that doesn't. And that stuff actually, those things are trying to tell you something about the aquifer. And I wouldn't base my my yield equations off of the largest well. I think what Carolyn said, I would be very conservative because you don't want to overallocate the water resource, which is very easy to do, especially when you're trying to, if you think about a well, actually, if you think about it, it's a hole in the ground, maybe that big. If you're lucky, it's this big. And you're trying to characterize the entire aquifer, like the Edwards Aquifer, that's 150 miles wide, and it's 150 miles long and 5 to 40 miles wide, and you're trying to characterize it off of a 6-inch diameter hole that may or may not hit some of these conduits, may or may not be completed in the units that you want. So you really need to use, you know, all of the tools that you have and be very careful about basing it on one well. More importantly is you don't want to throw out those outliers because they're trying to tell you something and maybe something very important. So I'm kind of like to look at all the data, scratch my head on it, and then as most geologists do, try and sidestep whatever question you're asking. So, yeah. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
We have, yeah. There appears to be troughs in the water table, which are indicative of very high permeability zones in parts of the Edwards that are probably related to large conduits. We find our largest yielding wells that are upgrading from what are called these Horst and Graben or Graben systems, and that so they seem to be upgrading of large faults. The Catfish Farmer wells that way. Some of the other artesian wells in Artesian, a few other places are that way. So there is some structure that plays a part. There's some stratigraphy that plays a part, and that plays a part in really identifying high yield versus low yield wells. I think that this process related to Artesian genesis and that. Probably plays a more important part, believe it or not, as we unravel this over the next couple of years, and that I think it will explain a lot about different units in the aquifer and why some of them seem to be more permeable than others. It explains the sponge rock. That's what's really nice. I've worked in a lot of carbonates, and that my background is in these carbonate these karst systems, and that. And one of the strange things about coming down here was seeing these rocks that look like sponges. And you don't see those in the great karst areas in Mammoth Cave or in Missouri or some of the other areas. And I was trying to figure out what they are. And what they are is the direct evidence of that vertical artesian process. The water is basically, instead of having a preferential flow path that you would get with water flowing over the surface and down, and it concentrates all the water, it's water trying to come up and out, and it's hitting an impermeable layer slightly above it and spreading out. And I'm pretty convinced of that now. We've been looking at this data for about 6 months to a year now, and it seems to explain a lot of what's going on. That stuff is overprinted on a lot of the structure stratigraphy of the area. So structure plays a big role. Stratigraphy plays a big role in moving water along with this vertical artesian speleogenesis process, I think. So anyway, have I worn you out? God, it's been a long day. All I can say is we've had a lot of rain, and I really think that's great because it makes life easier. And I'd like to take full credit for the rain. Thank you. I brought it up with me. So thank you all very much.
So thank you all very much for coming. Thank you for staying. Definitely use the contact sheet to ask questions. Give us a call. Do what you need to do, and be careful driving home. Thanks.